It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report, and we are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, journalist Tom Junod with Esquire magazine on the lethal presidency of Barack Obama. And meanwhile, Mitt Romney just falling apart. I meant to say this last week, but allow me to say it retroactively. Horrible candidate. In fact, I did say it last week. LIBOR scandal continues to grow. The Disclose Act will be hitting the Senate floor today. Senators will be staying there all night. Global warming taking its toll across the country with a massive drought. One of the worst, one of the top five worst droughts in the history of the country. And growing. Small benefit for those devastated by the Great Recession. The Obama administration relaxing welfare rules, or at least giving states some latitude to deal with the disaster that was President Clinton's welfare reform. And we have a new Iowa senator, apparently, appointed by herself. Yes. Yes, Matt. She is a Republican senator from Iowa. Not quite clear on, I don't know if she's actually set up a whole new country. We will talk about that later, but yes, it just gets crazier and crazier. And, everything that you've been reading by the media in regards to statements by the Obama administration, or for that matter, the Romney campaign, they've signed off on it. Those entities that gave the quotes, signed off on them, had a chance to massage them afterwards. And a new poll shows that liberals not terribly enamored with TV news. I wonder why. Today, Monday, the Senate will vote on the Disclose Act, authored by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. It would require large organizations which are spending over $10,000 on any political activities that use the name or likeness of a political candidate, so obviously within the context of a campaign, to file disclosure reports with the federal government, including the names of any of those large donors. It would also include a stand-by-your-ad provision which would require the leading donors, essentially, to have their name associated with the ad in some way. There are, I believe, 27 or 28 sponsors in the Senate It's widely expected that all the Democrats will support this. Of course, we don't have 60 Democrats in the Senate, so the Republicans will prevent this from coming to a vote. And my understanding is that a group of Democratic senators will essentially attempt to hold the floor throughout the night, trying to force another vote tomorrow on the Disclose Act. The idea is, of course, to focus the public's attention on this. You'll remember that one of the parts of Citizens United, you had Justice Anthony Kennedy claiming that this is okay because of disclosure rules by the Federal Elections Commission. And we found that those disclosure rules just didn't work. The super PACs have found massive loopholes. And so the names of people who support these things generally, if it comes out at all, ends up coming out months and months after the ads have run. And just as a side note, Senator John McCain came out very forcefully for the need for disclosure and will now be voting against the bill because he's still a Republican. And it doesn't look like he has any hopes of running for president again as a Democrat, so chances are you will not hear a raft of stories of him contemplating switching parties just because the guy is so principled. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tom Junod of Esquire magazine. Hello, this episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Right now, you can get a free Audible book download if you go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up Guy Lawson's first book, The Brotherhood, the true story of two cops who murdered for the mafia? If you want to read something that's not quite political, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report and pick up a free book, audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not? We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program a writer with Esquire magazine, Tom Junod, who's also, I should say, a winner of two national magazine awards. Tom, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
Tom, are you there?
Yeah. Sam, you blanked out just a second.
Oh, well.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
That'll happen to me on occasion. Don't panic
if I
pass out in the middle of this again. I read your piece in Esquire magazine. It is it's a beautifully written essay, and a little bit different in terms of what we generally see in reporting on this issue of President Obama's what you call a most the lethal presidency. You've written it as a letter to him. I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, you faded out again, though. I don't know whether it's my line or yours, Sam. I'm sorry for this. We're talking on a landline, but I don't know what's going on.
I'm sorry about that. Well, you sound great on our end, so
okay.
Just let me know if there's a problem. But I want to start... tell us what inspired you to write this piece? And we have talked on this program about Anwar al-Awlaki and his son and this program of targeted killing and of signature strikes by drones. But I'm curious, I want to start, what inspired you to write the piece in the way that you did?
Well, I mean, I've actually been thinking about writing the piece for probably for about 2 years. As soon as the drone strikes and the And not just the drone strikes, but the nighttime raids, the conduct of the war in Afghanistan as a sort of a capture and kill war, the whole sort of footing of the Obama administration has been towards individualized and targeted killing, and that just had struck me as a you know really sort of a silent historical revolution. So I was, you know, very, very interested in it and, you know, mentioned it to my editors. They sort of thought it might be a kind of an abstruse policy piece. And when we found out about Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, being killed, you know, sort of in the same way as his father, that was the thing that sort of allowed me to go forward because it sort of supplied a narrative to hook the thing to.
All right, Tom, we're getting just a little bit of feedback on your phone. I'm going to ring you right back.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tim. And I can't hear the feedback, which is always a good thing.
Okay, but, I'll call you right back.
So
no
just
problem.
Call me back now. Okay. All right.
All right, folks, we're just we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, Tom, that sounds much better. I don't know, we just had a little bit of a problem. We'll be on in a second. So you set out to write this piece and to explain this policy, which to a large extent has gotten not a tremendous amount of attention. Talk about how what kind of departure this represents, if any. I mean, certainly this program, in some sense, was started under Bush. How has this program changed, grown, and been, in some ways, redefined?
Well, I mean, I think that the thing that we really have to remember when we talk about these programs is, I mean, a lot of the defenders of the programs will say that, hey, you know, we've been targeting people in war for, you know, really our entire history. And they mention a Japanese general who was targeted in World War II, and so on. But you know, really, by the late 1990s, thanks to a variety of different things, I mean, it was absolutely taboo for the government to target an individual personally. You know, someone whose name was known, whose face was known, and to go after that person and kill that person. The CIA was extremely reluctant to do it. They were extremely reluctant to pull the trigger. The executive order against assassinations was, nobody knew exactly how far that order reached. So there was generally a taboo against this thing, a line to be crossed. The Bush administration crossed that line about a year or a year and a half after 9/11 with a drone strike in Yemen that happened to kill also an American citizen, but it was not a targeting of an American citizen. The American citizen happened to be there. But then by the end of the Bush administration, they were starting to do signature strikes in Pakistan, which had increased that, you know, and expanded that program. What is different with the Obama administration is not, you know, I mean, really, I think that they had their first strike, I think, 2 days after the inauguration. They kept going with that. And then, you know, they have basically created a legal and moral apparatus by which this program could be continued and continually expanded.
And we should just say that signature strikes are a function of sort of context. There's reason to believe that supposed militants are in a particular area, whereas a specific strike would deal with, we know we are going after this person and that person is there.
Yeah, one is called profile strikes or profile strikes, and the other called signature strikes. Profile strike is where they actually sort of know the name of the person and they have human intelligence on them. A signature strike is, you know, basically a patterns of movement and association. A former member of the Obama administration called me last week to tell me that, you know, really when you look at it, signature strikes are really not that much different from the way that we have always fought war. You know, movement association has been sort of a, ingredient of us going after troops for, you know, a long, long time. But, you know, he admitted, and I discussed with him, that, you know, with individuals, it's just it really is a very different thing. And
right.
Nobody knows exactly why.
And I would say also that the one of the fundamental differences about signature strikes is that when we have done those in the past, generally there has been the context has been a lot more clear as to that we're actually in a war with
right.
these individuals. And let's leave that for a moment and talk about these profile strikes. And I want to just remain on one more element of the policy, because you touch on this and you just mentioned it, that the Obama administration basically attempted to create a legal framework for these type of profile strikes in a way that the Bush administration didn't. And that is, at least in some ways, consistent with the differences that people like Charlie Savage have written about the two administrations. That they're not necessarily
right.
doing different things, but in some ways, the Obama administration is codifying these things in a way that the Bush administration never did.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a couple of different differences. One of them, you know, is that the Obama administration, and as the people, you know, who were and are in the Obama administration will be the first to tell you, the Obama administration uses the congressional authorization for the use of force as the basis, the legal basis, for doing the strikes, while the Bush administration used the Commander-in-Chief Clause of the Constitution. Basically, the Obama administration is saying that they are constrained by Congress in these things, and that Congress has sought, you know, has deemed them good and legal, where the Bush administration says, you know, the Constitution gives us authority to protect the United States. Congress has really no power to regulate what we do.
And you know, it may mean very little for the person on the other end of that strike, but
I would say less than little.
Right.
But yeah.
But ultimately, you know, to the extent that there is, well, upside. But I mean, this is an important distinction, at least to the extent that for those of us who might have a desire for a program like this to end, that at least there's a mechanism to end it. It's not embedded in the very essence of our Constitution.
Yeah, that's right. I talked to one, you know, former, you know, lawyer for the administration, sort of a big person with the construction of this of the policy, and he said that if Congress outlawed it, they would stop doing it tomorrow.
And so let's talk about.
But Congress is not going to outlaw it.
No.
I mean that is the other reality of this. The various committees, the Intelligence Committee and the Armed Forces Committees, you know, have oversight over these programs, and they will tell you that they work very hard at oversight. But it's, you know, it's after the fact oversight. It's not public oversight. There's been no hearings on any of these things. And, you know, and the question is whether there is any political will for pushback.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me there's very little, although I have to say that I did ask Senator Sheldon Whitehouse a couple of weeks ago if any member of any committee that he was aware of had seen the legal, the memo that basically outlines the legal justification of finding that judicial review is not necessary, that one can have
right,
due process
right.
without that. So that seems to be one element that's sort of extant, I guess.
Right, right.
And so
and I believe that, you know, Dianne Feinstein, you know, has called for the release of that memo. The administration has definitely not gone along with that.
So let's back up here and tell us the story of Anwar al-Awlaki.
Well, the story of Anwar al-Awlaki is fairly familiar to U.S. audiences. You know, he was his father was a Yemeni who came in the late '60s to the United States to study business and agriculture at U.S. universities. He Anwar was born in Las Cruces, New Mexico, while Nasser al-Awlaki was going to school at New Mexico State. They moved to Lincoln, Nebraska. They moved to Minnesota, where Nasser was studying and had various academic jobs. They moved back to Yemen when Anwar was 7 or 8. He came back here on a scholarship of his own when he was 18. He was, he was the new Muslim in a lot of different ways. He became an imam when he was studying at Colorado State and got a job at a mosque in San Diego. But when he was, he got a big job at a mosque in Falls Church, Virginia. He was sort of being, called upon to be an ambassador for Islam to young people in the United States. He had a big role. He had a bunch of popular CDs that were being sold that sort of explicated and extolled the life of the Prophet. And he really had a way of connecting with young audiences really from the start. At the same time, when he was in San Diego, there was some of the people who later showed up as 9/11 hijackers attended services at his mosque. They showed up again at the mosque in Virginia. And he was, after the 9/11 attacks, he was questioned heavily. He basically thought that he was being harassed, or said that he thought that he was being harassed. He fled to London. He began his sort of inflammatory speeches against the United States, both to crowds of young Muslims, and he started doing it online. And his ability to connect with sort of young, disaffected Muslims without really that were sort of like him, sort of like people without a country, made him a tremendous threat. He sort of situated himself in that place between inflammatory rhetoric and outright plotting for a long time. Finally, he was arrested in Yemen on a dispute that nobody seems to know anything about, but he was questioned in jail by the FBI twice. He was in solitary confinement for a year, got out, fled into the mountains.
This is now 2007 at this point.
Yeah, it's around 2007. Took up with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Basically started, correspondence with people who sought him out. One of which was the Fort Hood shooter, who also attended his church the mosque in Virginia. And the other one was the Christmas Day bomber from 2009, the guy who went on the Northwest Flight 253 with a bomb sewn into his underwear and ignited it. It ignited rather than exploded. But he was Anwar al-Awlaki was said to have a operational role in that plot. And so shortly afterwards, he wound up on a kill list, even though he was a U.S. citizen who had not been tried for these crimes, or even charged with them, in fact. He wound up on a kill list and was killed last year in September.
And by a profile drone strike. And just
right.
And let's just talk about this question of operational. We have seen, or at least ostensibly, these emails between al-Awlaki and the Fort Hood shooter and the Christmas would-be bomber, I guess. Have you seen those?
I've seen the ones between him and the Fort Hood, but not all the ones between him and the Christmas Day bomber.
And I mean, is there any evidence from those that he was operational? I mean, for a moment, putting aside the question of whether or not, we're in a position to make that determination when it leads to a profile strike. But I mean, how would you characterize those exchanges?
Well, it's interesting that he wanted the correspondence with the Fort Hood shooter to be published. because, I mean, I think that he knew what he was about. He had the ability, you know, for whatever reason to, I hate to use the word inspire here, but I guess inspire is what we're going to have to use right now. But he had the ability to motivate or incite is what I'm trying to get at. But he had the ability to incite a certain kind of person to commit acts of terror against the United States. So he wanted those things published, and he knew that he, you know, sort of that he was, I think at that time, he knew that he could stay at one side of that divide and still do significant damage. The operational stuff came out not just from the, or not strictly because of the emails with the Christmas Day bomber, the underwear bomber. They came out because the underwear bomber later cooperated with authorities, and when he was sentenced, the government attached an affidavit to that sentencing that sort of detailed the operational input that Anwar al-Awlaki gave to the bomber.
And beyond that, I guess, somewhat publicly available information, we don't know if there was other information or how that information was used in the supposed due process that was afforded him in terms of this profile strike.
Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, there are some, you know, some books that have come out about this. You know, I mean, I think that some of the deliberations of the administration are written about in Daniel Klayman's book, Killer Capture, and maybe in some of the other books that have come out. But yeah, this was, they decided to kill him, I guess, in what, January of 2010. And the Washington Post came out with a story, 2 weeks afterwards or something, that said that he was on the kill list. There's all sorts of suspicion about why that was leaked to the Washington Post, and you know, there are even some, you know, some people who believe that they leaked it to the Post as really as part of the due process, quote unquote, that was being afforded him, that they were giving him notice. And his father, you know, indeed read the Nasser al-Awlaki read that piece and contacted the ACLU. And, you know, basically from that point on had, you know, tried to sue the government to enjoin the government from killing him.
And failed because ostensibly the father didn't have standing. And I guess the idea being that, well, al-Awlaki, despite the fact that there is a bounty on his head, more or less, should have come into court to argue
right.
that the government shouldn't kill him. I mean,
right.
And before we get to the story of al-Awlaki's son, how is it that the administration both claims authority that they find analogous to one in a time of war, but also feels that they are obligated to pursue some form of due process, despite the fact that, I mean, for a moment, put aside whether or not that's actually due process, they've determined that it
right.
is. But why do they,
right.
why is it necessary for them to even go through this so-called due process if it is a, if it is an authority that the U.S. government has exercised many times before, and presumably they didn't go through that process?
Well, I think that the big difference here is the citizenship of Anwar al-Awlaki. You know, they I think that recognized that they decided that they could kill a citizen who was at war with the United States, but they decided that they had to give him some form of due process, while sort of knowing all the time, I think, that they were going to go after him.
Right.
I don't know how sincere. I mean, the idea that this was sort of an open question, like that anybody could have said, we're not going to, you know, kill this man, I think is, you know, open to debate, at least.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least. And, I mean, do you have a sense, I mean, did you have, in the course of your reporting, did you find anything other than the very broad outlines that we've heard about with this so-called due process? Because as far as what I've read, it's really just some number of people from different agencies who ultimately have their job is to, you know, I mean, to kill people to in one form or another. Debating about this. I mean, have you seen any reporting that, well, we appoint, someone, an advocate, for this person? I mean,
I've not seen that. I mean, I've seen, you know, I saw something that came from, Klaibman's book that, you know, basically that Harold Koh, who, is the counsel for the State Department and, a principled, defender of the United States' need to follow international law, you know, apparently, you know, looked over the documents for 5 hours or something before ultimately, you know, conceding that Anwar al-Awlaki could be killed. But, I think he also said at the same time that turning around that particular ship is, you know, would have been extremely, extremely difficult. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, I think that all the momentum was towards killing Anwar al-Awlaki, right, sort of no matter what.
And so, and then your piece also talks extensively about al-Awlaki's son, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki. Is that
Abdul Rahman?
Abdul Rahman. Tell us about him.
Well, you know, it was it's sort of the Anwar story played twice. I mean, he was when Anwar al-Awlaki was studying in the United States, his son Abdul Rahman was born, followed his father to San Diego, followed his father to Washington, and then when his father sort of left the United States, he followed him as well. He lived with Nasser al-Awlaki is a very successful man in Yemen. He was the president of the university in Sana'a, which is the main university there. He was held a ministerial position in the government, and so he owns a big apartment in Sana'a, and he lived there. Abdul Rahman lived there with his mother's and his brother and sisters, while his father fled into the mountains to pursue what he was pursuing with Al Qaeda, Arabian Peninsula. He was apparently always very, very close to his father. And when his father was hiding out last year, and when his father showed up on the kill list, he left one day. He climbed out through the kitchen window one day. His sisters went looking for him in bed. He was not there. His mother eventually found a note saying, you know, I've gone to find my father. And where he went, he had no idea where his father was. Where he went was the sort of the tribal village where the al-Awlaki clan sort of has its center, and which is down by the fairly close to the Arabian Sea. He thought he was trying to find his father. I think he was 400 kilometers from his father. His father was up in the mountains. He didn't know that. He lived with his father's cousin. And was friends with his own second cousin. He was 16 years old. The second cousin was 17. And so he was, you know, he was down there for what I think almost a month, staying with his, you know, sort of in the family fold. And after the news came that Anwar al-Awlaki had been killed, he phoned his mother, said, I'm coming back home. The roads are apparently dangerous because Yemen at the time was full of sectarian strife. He stayed down where he was for about another week and a half, 2 weeks, basically was in the process of saying goodbye was sitting by an outdoor fire one night eating dinner with a bunch of teenage boys. I believe there was a count. It was supposed to be 7 of them. And, you know, a drone came and killed them all.
And how has this strike been characterized by the administration?
it's not been characterized. I mean, it has been there's been some sort of word through leak that it was, you know, considered a mistake and this was collateral damage. That's what I mean. I talked to Senator Carl Levin, who is the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and he said it was, collateral damage. Talked to others on the intelligence committees; they said it was collateral damage. CIA wouldn't say anything. The administration has not said a word about it, even though, you know, the situation is that he was also a citizen.
That's pretty stunning, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's amazing. And really, that's one of the reasons that last week I sort of blogged at Esquire.com sort of extensively about the story and the repercussions of the story. But the thing that I really tried to do in the beginning is just call for one simple law to rein this, what I call the lethal presidency, in. And that law would basically not allow the administration or any administration to kill an American citizen without some sort of accountability, without some sort of acknowledgement. It seems perverse and to me, you know, directly at odds with the Constitution to kill an American citizen and then not to say anything about it, to keep in the circumstances entirely secret.
And I have to say that sort of the amount of attention this has received from the press has been stunning in its absence. I mean, that there is no even cursory press release put out about this by the administration, and that there hasn't been any type of clamor for one is pretty shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it would seem that it would be easy to press for a law that would say, okay, if we kill a citizen, there is going to be an open hearing in Congress about what happened and why. There's no momentum towards that whatsoever. And in fact, you know, I got a call last week from a figure who, you know, knows these things and was tied to the administration at pretty high levels. And he called to sort of educate me about what was the forces that were against this kind of revelation or this kind of acknowledgement. And he basically said that, you know, the president and the political people in the administration are all for transparency, but there are these deals that have been worked out between the United States and the countries where it's doing these programs called, I think that these kind of deals there's a lot of them for many kind of different things. It's not just for drones. But these are called the requirement of non-acknowledgement. You know, basically where you tell the ruler of Yemen that, you know, you will not say that you are doing these things as Yemen as the price of doing these things in Yemen. And this requirement of non-acknowledgement, you know, becomes the trump card. And it trumps, you know, legal principle, and it trumps the Constitution itself.
And from your reporting with any of those senators, was there any indication that the leaks that this was collateral damage were accurate, inaccurate?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I talked to, you know, if you talk to Nasser al-Awlaki, if you talk to Anwar's father and Abdulrahman's grandfather, he will tell you that, you know, he can prove that the United States targeted Abdulrahman out of spite or because they thought that, you know, he was presented the possibility of revenge or all of this kind of stuff. I think that he is a man who has lost both his son and his grandfather and also, I think, a nephew. So, I mean, he has, you know, every reason to be suspicious of the administration and to accuse it of various things. But I talked to some people at a human rights commission in Yemen, and they said that there is no evidence that Abdulrahman was purposefully targeted by the United States, that it seemed to be some sort of collateral damage sort of situation. But to me, that's not even the point. The point is that, you know, an American citizen was killed, and there simply should be some kind of accountability, and it's just, it's amazing that there's not.
You also write in your piece, since taking office, you, and this again is essentially an open letter you've addressed to President Obama, you have killed thousands of people identified as terrorists or militants outside the theater of Afghanistan. You have captured and detained one. Right. What in your reporting makes this this relevant, if it's not clear to people?
What makes it relevant?
This dynamic. There's some thought that this is that it's a question of convenience.
Well, that is the question. I mean, the thing that I write about in my story that I really try to get at is that the administration has confused killing with scruple. That killing is somehow a cleaner and more moral business than the things that got the Bush administration really in so much disrepute. And for a long time, I think that argument worked. Killing seemed to be accepted as sort of this better alternative to the really messy problems of dealing with terrorists. You know, I talked to Senator Lindsey Graham for the story, and he gave me a terrifically honest and open interview where he said he talked to, you know, operators who, because we don't have, you know, really any sort of place right now for the any sort of places for the detention of terrorists, that they kill people because they know it's easier, and that there's not going to be any sort of odd, you know, and unforeseen repercussions. And, you know, if that is the truth, you know, to me, we are pursuing a greatly immoral policy.
And one that's just simply born on political convenience.
Yeah, or that has ingredients of political convenience in it. I'm not saying that the administration is doing this strictly out of political convenience. Obviously, if you talk to them, they would say that they have good intentions and that they're doing it to protect the country from its enemies, and that we are at war with Al Qaeda, and this is the way that we're prosecuting this war. So I'm not going to say that we are, you know, that this is entirely a matter of political convenience, but, you know, the question is, you know, when you look at the numbers, where has political convenience crept into the process? And, you know, we'll never know that because it's a secret process, but it seems to be there.
And lastly, you know, we talk about how President Obama had taken this innovated, I guess, in the context of this program, which is, I don't know, a creepy word, but I don't know how better to express it, from where the Bush administration was, and also codified it, brought it into at least some context of rule of law, despite the fact that you have the sort of those black holes with where we don't exactly know, based upon what the due process can be, military personnel sitting in a room talking
right.
about it.
Right.
But there's also one of the biggest black holes is this sort of notion, even if we take what the administration is saying at face value, that President Obama is very judicious when he makes this determination. I mean, that's sort of the problem. Even I think its proponents would have a problem with that. It's not a process if it is a function of the persons involved in the process making the decision.
That to me is the biggest danger of this whole thing, is that there is in all the public statements that the administration has made about this, and there have been numerous ones. There is this idea that, you know, listen, we are trying very hard here. We are really being careful, and that ultimately that this is a moral process because we are moral men. And I think that that argument is, you know, personally, I believe it's dangerous to democracy. I mean, I think that the Constitution has been created expressly to check the claims of so-called moral men, and to basically to subject these things to oversight that private morality that goes beyond private morality. And the administration, to me, has tried to locate due process in private morality once again. And that's, you know, that you're talking the power of kings here, rather than the power of a democratically elected president.
I mean, that's the ultimate irony of these claims, is that it seems to me the Obama administration separate for a moment what they do relative to what the Bush administration did. The Obama administration seems to comfort itself based upon this notion that we have taken all of these processes and brought them into a legal framework that is not based on the unitary executive theory and whatnot. But in some ways, right, because they've done that, these processes become even more dangerous. And yet they still, for the reason, the fact that now we have legalized what at least some before would have argued with at least, you know, more obvious, backing that it was a rogue operation. They've now taken what was rogue, ostensibly put it into a legal framework, and then leave the underpinnings of it still a function of an individual rather than a process.
Yeah, one of the administration former administration people that I talked to basically saying that this, you know, the approach is very consistent with the administration's idea that absent judicial process, the really the best you can do to bring this closer to due process is to put it in the hands of the president. And you know that, you know, I don't know how that sounds to you, but it sounds, you know, it doesn't sound like the American way to me.
Tom Juneau from Esquire magazine. We'll put a link up to the piece at majority.fm. Thanks so much for taking time talking
to us
today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sam.
Thank you, Tom.
Take care. Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a longer than a quick break. Well, we'll take a quick break. We're going to head into the better half of the program. You can support this show by becoming a member. We need your support. I say this every day. It's the case. We don't accept institutional funding. We don't accept bags of money from George Soros. Not that I don't want to discourage anybody from who's listening out there. I mean, but this show maintains its independence and its, I don't know, unique flavor. Am I saying that right, Matt? Yeah?
I would say so.
Because we are supported by our members. And we can only continue to do that if you continue to support us. So please, if you can afford it, become a member today at majority.fm. You pay for your cable. You pay for your... I mean, think of all the crap you pay for. I think like one pair of jeans. I mean, not the kind of jeans I buy, but one pair of jeans could pay for your membership for the entire year, and you don't even wear those anymore. They went out of style as soon as you bought them. It's experiences that make you happy, folks, not buying junk. So please become a member today if you can. If not, and you still want access to the better half of the program, email me at Majority Reporters. We'll work something out.
And if you do have to buy junk, buy it through our Amazon link.
That's right. If you do need to buy junk and you buy it through Amazon, buy it through our link. You can go to majority.fm/support the show. Find our Amazon link. Click it. Bookmark it. Always buy your junk through there. It's very easy for you to do. And it will at least mitigate some of the guilt that you feel every time you hear me say this. I do. I get emails. Well, not enough, but people saying, like, I finally broke down and become a member. I don't know why I didn't do this a year ago. Folks, don't procrastinate. Get your act together, for gosh sakes. You can also buy merch. You can also give us a good review on iTunes. You can go to donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Help spread the word. Tell your friends. Write to other podcasts you listen to. Tell them to have me on as a guest. There's a 25% chance I will do it. 35% chance if I know that... No, 75% chance if I know that you've written an email to them and inspired that request. 85% chance. You want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. The IM is Majority FM. The better half, we will explain to you why we actually now have an extra senator from Iowa. I don't even know if this story is true. I really don't. It's so crazy. All right, see you in the better half.